Okay, so today I really wanted to start with chapter 6, so discussing numerical schemes for hyperbolic systems of conservation laws. And so this is essentially what we were working toward for, you know, the last several weeks, essentially from the very beginning of this lecture course. And so now comes the sort of the most interesting, I'd say, and most relevant part, trying to understand how we actually solve hyperbolic systems in general. So the problem is, as usual, we're interested in a hyperbolic system, which we can always write in the form ut plus f of u x equals zero. And we assume we have some generic initial data. So now we're not focusing specifically on the Riemann problem, but we're just focusing. We leave that essentially open and just consider any arbitrary initial data for now. And so also we'll focus here on one spatial dimension as usual, with the extension to multi-dimensions is something we'll actually do in the last week of this course, where we'll discuss how to generalize these numerical schemes that we're now going to discuss to higher dimensions, so to hyperbolic systems in higher dimensions. And it will turn out that actually this generalization is fairly straightforward to do. There are a few subtleties, obviously, to consider, but in the end, it's fairly straightforward. So we can, for now, concentrate on the 1D case. So let me start by introducing the notion of conservative schemes. And these are special numerical schemes to solve conservation laws or systems of conservation laws. And they have the crucial property that they keep the sort of central property of the analytic equations, namely that the set of conserved variables stays actually conserved on the numerical level. And so this is a critical property, obviously, of conservation laws. And we do want that property to be conserved on the numerical level as well. And we'll see that this property also then ensures some type of convergence to a weak solution of the system of conservation laws. So this will be a critical property. And the sort of motivation or the derivation of that scheme then essentially starts by looking at the integral version. So on the sort of the integral version of the conservation law that states conservation of the conserved variables. So the idea is we'll start by integrating the system of conservation laws over a control volume, and then we'll try to see. We'll try to break this down to a single cell, and from there we'll get an explicit expression for how the numerical scheme should look like in order to conserve the state vectors, or the set of conserved variables. So let's focus here on such a control volume in physical space. So let's say this is our space and this is our time axis. And then let's say we have, for now, a rectangular control volume V, where we have some minimum x value and some maximum. And then we have some t minimum and t max. And let's say we integrate our conservation law over that control volume. So let's denote these equations here by one and two. So integrate one over control volume V. we find the following. So we can directly integrate the first term in time while we integrate the second term in space. So we'll integrate the fluxes over space. And if we sort of now go to the limit where we set V equal to one single grid cell, centered around say xi, so we have our control volume will be then xi minus 1/2, xi plus 1/2, and here we'll just have, let's use the time steps tn and tn plus 1. So say this is I minus 1/2. And so all of this is centered around xi, then we get the following expression. I'll denote this by star because we'll refer to this a couple of times. Xi minus 1/2 to xi plus 1/2. So it's just rewriting what we found above, just to make things very explicit. Xi minus 1/2, comma t dt equals 0. So essentially note that this here is the change in our conserved quantity u. In this control volume, so in the cell xi minus 1/2, xi plus 1/2, during the time interval tn to tn plus 1, and so what we have here is essentially the flow or flux difference through the cell interfaces. So along essentially these interfaces here, during this time step delta t from tn to tn plus 1, And to rewrite this a little bit, let's make the following definitions and assumptions. So let's assume there is a function which we'll call the numerical flux G that takes in two state vectors and projects it to another state vector where, so Rm is our state vector space, where M is again the number of equations we have. And so this is what we'll call the numerical flux. Such that the following holds. So we'll first make a definition and say that what we now define as UIN, which in the finite differencing paradigm essentially was the grid function just evaluated at some grid point xi and time tn. Here now we'll use a finite volume approach. And so we'll set this equal to the average over the exact function or over the solution u of x and t at time tn in the grid, given grid cell, which will be centered around xi. So we just, so this is the average conserved variable in cell I. So we just average over one grid cell. And so you'll see that obviously this is motivated by this first term up here. So we'll be able to replace this integral here with these definitions. And then in order to deal with the second term here, we will define this numerical flux. And so we'll define this function. So we assume that there's some function g that is just defined in the following way. So it takes ui n and then ui plus 1 n. And we take this to approximate the flux in this time interval from tn to tn plus 1. At the cell interface that is determined by ui and ui plus 1. So at the respective interface, which is then at xi plus 1 half, we'll compute the average flux through that time interval delta t. And this is exactly what appears here on in this integral here. So this will be the average flux. So just in words, through the interface in the time interval delta t. And so similarly, g at I minus 1/2 n would be ui minus 1 n comma ui n, which will be, which will approximate here 1 over delta t tn, tn plus 1 f of u x I minus 1/2 comma t dt. So that with these definitions, we can write our integral form of the conservation law up here in the following way. UIN plus 1 minus UIN equals minus delta t over delta x. G at I plus 1/2 n, and then minus G I minus 1/2 n. And this is essentially the prototype expression for a conservative scheme. And so before we'll sort of write this definition down in a sort of more formal way, I just wanted to make one more comment on this numerical flux function G. So there are a few things that this flux function G should actually satisfy, and this is usually what's referred to as consistency properties. So this numerical flux function G needs to satisfy the following two properties. So first, we need to ensure that in some special cases, G actually equals the actual physical flux. And this is what is referred to as G is consistent with the physical flux. So that means that we require that in the limit where both vectors that we insert into the G, we actually recover the physical flux for any such vector in our state space. And that's because of the following. So you can easily see why we want that property. So for example, if we consider constant initial data, say U naught equals constant, then U equals U naught is a solution of our conservation law. And just using the above definitions, we can calculate the numerical flux at the initial time level. And since this is constant, we have just G of U naught or you know, we can just take any can just use any I to do that. But also we find that we just take the definition of what the numerical flux actually approximates from 0 to delta t, then we find that this is exactly given by the physical flux. So if we integrate from the zero, from t equals zero to to t equals delta t with u equals u0 being constant, this is exactly just f of u0, which is constant, so we integrate over something constant, so this is f of u0, and so you can see, for example, why, so in the simple example, why we want that this condition up here is being satisfied by our numerical flux. And also, we don't just want this in the limit where essentially both of these vectors are identical. We actually want a continuous property so that the following holds. So we want general, meaning that if we just approach V, that the same property holds. And so this leads to this notion of Lipschitz continuity. So as the two arguments we input there, as they vary, i.e. what we want is that this also approximates the physical flux as ui plus 1 and ui approach v. And so this is typically what is then expressed in terms of a requirement in terms of Lipschitz continuity. So usually one then requires that there exists constants such that the following holds. So this is sort of a little technical statement, but essentially what it says is just that this numerical flux function should actually just reasonably approximate the physical flux. So this is sort of a reasonable property to assume here. And so both of these properties, so both essentially the statement that at sort of at the state V, the numerical flux is equivalent to the physical flux. Also, if we go sort of a little bit away of that, we have some controlled manner in which G differs, in which sort of the numerical flux differs from the physical flux. And sort of these two properties are just usually referred to as consistency properties of the numerical flux. And sort of with this at hand, we can finally write down the definition of a conservative scheme.
Sorry, Daniel.
Yes?
One tiny question. Is there any requirement on like alpha? Like,
yeah, that's a good question.
What's any assumption, anything, or just whatever alpha? I guess like positive or something like that. But
yes, yeah. So exactly. So it has to be positive, obviously. But but usually, like alpha equals one is what you would typically require. So if you want to have even higher convergence, essentially, then you know you can go higher than that. But essentially, that is irrelevant. As long as you have alpha equals one, that's fine. And essentially, all the main theorems, like the Lux-Wendorf theorem for convergence and other things, will work in this case. So essentially, it's not too sensitive on this exponent. Yeah, but good question.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. So yeah, let's say alpha. So typically, alpha equals one. But essentially, the exact value doesn't matter too much. Okay, so let's write down essentially the definition of a conservative scheme. So let's say we have a conservation law with a flux function that is differentiable. So that we need to assume so that the Jacobian exists, and we can actually write down well-defined eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And now comes this critical sort of assumption here, and this essentially the foregoing remarks were essentially just to motivate this definition here, or this assumption here, that namely this numerical flux is C0, comma 1, where 0 means it's our usual sort of level of differentiability. So in this case, it just needs to be continuous. So this should be a continuous function, but this comma one then indicates the exponent alpha here. So the order of Lipschitz continuity. And usually one just assumes alpha equals one, and sort of all the following statements will hold, but they are fairly insensitive to the exact value of alpha. And so here again, we plug in two vectors, right? And we get one state vector back. And so this Lipschitz continuity is actually important for the Lux-Wendorf theorem. We'll actually, I'll write this down in you know, a few minutes from now. And we'll see where this Lipschitz continuity requirement actually plays a critical role. So with the system of conservation laws, which means that again, we need G, V comma V equals F of V for all state vectors. And assume we have some numerical grid. And discretized initial data. Then a scheme of the form ui n plus 1 equals ui n. And so this is our result from above, minus delta t over delta x, multiplying this flux, numerical flux difference to the numerical flux difference at the cell interfaces. said to be. In conservative form. Oops. With numerical flux. Flux G. Okay, so this is essentially just a way of writing down the integral version of the conservation law in a discretized way. This is essentially the idea. So this is an explicit version where we obtain the state vector at tn plus one, as you can see here, through an explicit relation where we can write down the right-hand side all in terms of known quantities at time step tn. So this is an explicit expression. One can generalize this to the following. To sort of an implicit or a hybrid form. So the error can be generalized and so the sort of most general form would be the following. So we again introduce this theta parameter. So this is similar to some of the finite differencing schemes that we were looking at for the linear advection problems. There we also had this theta parameter that sort of interpolated between the two extreme cases between an explicit and an implicit scheme. And the same thing can be done here for the nonlinear equations in conservation form. So here this theta parameter simply couples the two time levels, n plus one and n. And so this should be actually a minus sign here. And we have one plus theta. And then we have the flux difference at time level Tn. And also need to close the curly bracket. So for theta being between 0 and 1, so you can easily convince yourself that if theta equals 0, we obtain again our explicit scheme that we just derived above. And for theta equals 1, we have a fully implicit scheme. So this would be essentially the sort of more general version of the previous definition. And The second point I wanted to briefly make here is that, and this is the crucial property, why we look at schemes of this form, one can easily see that they conserve the state vector on the discrete level.
Just really quick, there's a yes. End, is there, on that last equation there, is there's an end curly brace in the front for the top line?
Right. And so there should be, I apologize, this was not good use of space here. So there's one here to close it.
Oh, wow. I mean the square brace on the top line.
Oh, okay. Yeah, you're right. I'm sorry. You're absolutely right. So this should close here.
Okay, cool.
Mm-hmm. Thanks. So, as I said, the crucial property, obviously, why we study conservation laws is because they express conservation of certain quantities that we evolve. And so we really want this to be satisfied on the discrete level as well. And so one can see this is actually the case here. So on the discretized level, so if we just sum over the flux terms on the right hand side, so let's just look at the explicit version. We can just sum over the right hand side over the flux differences and see that they actually cancel. Because what we have here is really that GUIN UI plus 1 N UI minus 1 and UI. And so every term here has a counter term. So the sum actually cancels. So if we sum over all cells, in our conservation law on the left hand side, on the definition of our scheme, we have on the left hand side UI n plus 1, we sum over all grid cells. And then on the right hand side, we will just be left with the sum over UI n. And so these flux terms essentially cancel. So what we have here is just the expression of conservation on the discretized level.
Daniel, are you assuming mm-hmm. there's no flux at the edge of your cells, the whole volume?
Yeah, that's a good question. Yeah, right. So I did not discuss boundary conditions here. So for now, we'll just restrict this to the interior of essentially of our grid. So obviously, you're right. In reality, we'll have some boundaries, and we will have to specify some boundary conditions there. And so, for example, if you have periodic boundary conditions, then it would exactly cancel again. And this is usually what for example, you would have to specify to make that consistent. But yeah, so there can be subtle details here depending on what kind of boundary conditions you want to specify. But for now, I'll just leave that discussion aside and just concentrate on the grid interior, assuming that essentially our computational domain extends to plus and minus infinity. But you're right. So in practice, one has to be careful at what one does at the boundaries to not spoil this conversion, this conservation property. And so the really crucial reason why we actually want this on the discrete level is because schemes that don't satisfy this on the discrete level are not guaranteed to converge to a weak solution of the conservation law. Because in general, those obviously the true solution, the weak solution to a conservation law must obviously satisfy such a conservation property. And so if we have a scheme that doesn't guarantee this, it is not guaranteed that scheme, if it converges, actually converges to the right weak solution, to the weak solution of the actual problem that we're interested in. So this is why we have to demand that right away. And sort of the formal reason for this is the so-called Lux-Wendroff theorem, which sort of formalizes this this notion, which is the next thing I'm going to discuss. But before that, maybe I should again stop and ask if there are any further questions on this so far.
So you don't have a scheme until you specify what G is.
Yes.
And, right. So the suspense is killing me. So is that easy, or can you always find the G that satisfies everything you need it to satisfy?
Yeah, great question. We'll discuss this on Thursday. We'll actually look at specific schemes on Thursday, in particular the so-called Godunov type schemes, where we can write down where we can explicitly write down such a flux. There are some easy examples. I don't include them here right now, some of which I will probably put on one of the following problem sets. So yeah, there are simple examples where you can write down a flux function that actually satisfies all these properties. So it's easy to design actually a conservative scheme. The problem will then be to find a flux function and thus a conservative scheme that actually picks out the entropy solution. So this will be the next problem. We'll have to specify a criterion, an additional criterion for the flux function, for this numerical flux function, so that we are also guaranteed to find the entropy and thus sort of the unique solution, the physically admissible solution to our initial value problem. So I will get back to more of this later on, probably on Thursday then.
Okay, thanks.
Mm-hmm. Daniel, I have a question.
Yes. Sure.
So like this thing is very nice because from like the definition you're having conservation, but I was wondering if there's like a dynamical way of like ensuring this sort of conservation as you do, for example, when you have constraints and you have something like constraint damping. There's like some sort of equivalent thing so that you don't have like this, because it's also like a constraint in the sense that you have to work within like this framework if you want something to. So is there like an equivalent that you can kind of like say, okay, yeah, this is working. We see that the thing is conserved. I just was wondering if there's something out there.
Yeah, that's actually a great question. So you're thinking in terms of like a driver condition. So where, like in the case of the Einstein equations, we We're not guaranteed to satisfy the constraint equations during evolution, but we can sort of invent some driver function that sort of drives our numerical solution toward satisfying the constraints. And so, yes, I think that's really great idea. One could, in principle, like for any scheme, sort of try to write down some driver function that would drive the numerical solution to satisfy the exact conservation on the discrete level. The problem then is, so I'm not aware of any such attempts to do this. And I believe the reason is that you would get lots of problems with convergence. So in that case, the Lux-Wendorf theorem that we're just about to discuss will not guarantee that you're actually converging to a weak solution. Because what we want to do is we you know, if you for example use a finite differencing scheme that is not conservative, then you may just look for a solution in the function space of differentiable functions, but you're losing the weak solution. You're restricting your problem to a much smaller function space. And so if you're working with a driver condition, you will still be in that function space, but you would not go into the actual, the so-called Sobolev spaces where the weak solutions live. And so this is one fundamental problem. So you have to, from the very beginning, you have to make sure that what your numerical scheme selects is a sequence in this bigger function space, in this bigger Sobolev space of weak solutions. And so this is why you want to start with that right away to make sure you can actually pick the right solution.
Okay, thank you.
Mm-hmm. Okay, anything else? Okay, if not, then we'll actually get to this critical point of convergence. And this is the famous Lux-Wendorf theorem. And this will then also lead us to define a discretized version of the entropy conditions afterward. So first I wanted to introduce this famous Lux-Wendorf theorem that sort of everyone sort of dealing with conservation laws on the numerical level should have heard about at some point. It's from the 1960s. So if you want to look up the actual paper, it's in Communications of Pure and Applied Mathematics, volume 13 to 170 to 137. And so the statement is that essentially, if you have this is what I already essentially mentioned, if you have a conservative scheme and you have a sequence of solutions that you compute with this conservative schemes at ever sort of increasing resolution. And if it converges, so assuming that the sequence converges, then this Lux-Wendorf theorem tells you that this limit will be a weak solution of the problem, so that you actually find the weak solution in this big sort of bigger Sobolev space. So sort of written in more formal language, this will be the following. So let's say we have this sequence of numerical solutions computed with such a conservative scheme. The scheme in conservation form. With respect to essentially ever increasing spatial and temporal resolution. So let's say we have a sequence of delta x, essentially, that we refine as L increases. And let's say we have the same thing for time, where also delta t decreases as we increase L. So both go to zero as we increase L. And also we assume that they do it at the roughly same rate. And then we assume that all of these numerical solutions are bounded, so none of them sort of explodes at some point. So we just assume that they are well behaved, and the mathematical statement we need here is that there exists a uniform boundary to all such solutions, so that UL x and t is bounded by this constant uniformly. So across all L, across the whole sequence of solutions as we refine, and also across all physical space. So it just means that UL is uniformly bounded. And also we assume that the scheme is actually converging almost everywhere. So again, in the notion of a weak solution in sort of in this integral fashion, where it converges except for a subset of measure zero. So it's almost everywhere. The statement is that if we have such a convergent series, then the limit is actually a weak solution. And so this is of great practical relevance, because obviously if we write down a conservative scheme, we say use our computer to calculate the sequence of solutions to a given problem at different resolutions. And if we sort of find that sort of heuristically that, you know, they are converging, at least as far as we can tell at finite resolution, then we know that we can sort of trust our results and the algorithm to pick out actually the weak solution to the problem. Now this the theorem doesn't yet tell us whether that weak solution is actually the one that we want, namely the weak solution that is consistent with the entropy conditions. And so this is what we'll discuss afterwards, how to guarantee that whatever numerical scheme we write down will then or sort of what the conditions are under which a numerical scheme would then also pick out the correct entropy solution. So the solution that's consistent with the entropy conditions. Okay. Quickly sort of glance over the proof of this theorem, simply because it's sort of a fairly important theorem in the numerics of conservation laws. And so the proof of the statement is not too long. I will sort of skip a few technical details here to make it a little short. So we'll just focus on the explicit case here. So this was our theta parameter zero. If we're in the implicit case, then everything is just analogous. So there are no big surprises there. And so the trick is now to again take a test function. We'll multiply our scheme by the test function, and we will see that sort of integrating, sort of summing over all grid cells, which is essentially the same as integrating, we can sort of recast the numerical scheme, the definition of the numerical scheme on the discrete level in terms of in terms of integrals. So we'll see that this sort of discrete version converges to an integral version, which is identical to the definition of a weak solution to the problem. So this is essentially the basic idea here. So we'll take some test function. And so again, here this zero index means that we choose one with compact support. So this is essentially what we've always done. So it just sort of reads out properties at a given time and space sort of location or area. And so let's multiply the scheme by this test function. So this will lead to this expression here. So where we've separated the flux term from the conservatives. And again, here we multiply by the test function. And so, as I said, the idea is now to sort of numerically integrate over this and show that this approaches an integral, so that this converges to an integral version that just expresses the fact that the limit U is a weak solution to the problem. So let's look at the left side first. Let's see what the left-hand side does. So first we'll sum over all times. And so we can just re-express the sum by reorganizing the terms. So one can easily convince oneself that this is equivalent to this expression here, where we just shift the differences in U into differences in the test function. So I have a few more details in the notes, which you can look up, which make some of these steps a little more explicit. So this is just essentially to sketch the idea here. I don't want to sort of bore you with too many details. But so the idea is to simply shift the summation to our test functions. And then again, using a few formulae with of you know in general these partial summation formulae, one can actually show that this is exactly equal to the integral. So this is not a surprise, but one can show that this is actually an exact identity where we can write this as a time derivative of the test function. And we just keep the zero initial time term here. And so this is, so where UL of XI and T is what we just called UIN. So this is at any given L of our sequence. So for any refinement that, you know, that we could potentially look at, this expression holds. So this is essentially the discrete time integration. Now we can also integrate over space. So we'll now add a sum over all spatial grid points as well. So we'll have finally delta x times these two sums. Multiplying our test function. So just plugging in the result from already converted this to a time integral. Dt dx. Minus. Oh, I'm sorry. This was one skipping one step ahead. So minus dt. Just time integral minus ui naught phi xi comma. Zero. Okay. And now we'll just replace the discrete sum by an integral. We'll just write this as an integral over the entire real axis. Dt dx. And so here we'll also have an integral over the initial data, dx. And so this replacement is only accurate to delta x, O of delta x. So there will be some sort of rest term here. But as we take the limit of L goes to infinity, where we just arbitrarily refine and increase our resolution, that error term will converge away. So what we'll find in the end is minus the integral, and then so by assumption, UL converges to U. So this will be the integral version that our discrete scheme will converge to. So the left-hand side essentially of our scheme will converge to. And now we can, you know, take the same approach and analyze the right-hand side of flux term. So this will be minus delta t sum over I. We'll do the same thing, sum over all spatial and time times, so all grid cells multiply by our test function. We can play the same trick as above. Apply partial summation and shift the differences to our test function. And so we'll just be left with this expression here. So phi of xi comma tn minus phi of xi plus 1 comma tn. And so since phi is differentiable, we can directly write this as essentially a derivative of phi. So we just reinterpret this difference as essentially a forward difference approximation to the derivative. This will give us an error term again of the order of O of delta x. But that is not much of a problem because that will converge away in the limit of L goes to infinity. So let's write this difference as a spatial derivative of phi plus some O of delta x rest. And now we do, let's actually first, before taking the limit, we need to set the following. So we'll just define the function gl at x comma t just as gi plus 1/2 n at the given refinement level given by L. So this is in the cell between xi and xi plus 1 and tn. So just sort of using the numerical flux function at this evaluated for the discretized u at this refinement sort of level. And so we can now write this again approximate this by integrals that again bring error terms of order delta x. So let's just write this as integral over R, integral over all times, this function gl of x comma t. And so we have some error term delta x coming both from the approximation of the spatial derivative of our test function, but also from approximating the discrete sums by integrals. And now we can again take the limit L goes to infinity. And this is actually now where the Lipschitz continuity property actually comes in, because this now actually guarantees us that GL at x, t converges to this expression, which again by consistency, the consistency condition of the numerical flux is actually f of u. So actually to see those convergence, there are a few technical subtleties here, which I won't go into right now, but you can look it up in the notes. And so this has to do with the fact that G is Lipschitz continuous. And if it was not, then we would not get this convergence behavior here. So this is why we need to assume this from the start. And so this is essentially the integral version that the right-hand side will converge to. And so putting the two together, we'll actually just see that this is equivalent to the definition of a weak solution to our conservation law. So if we take these two expressions here together, we see that the discretized version up here, will be our second part. And so this is the left-hand side, our first part. So this discrete expression up here will converge to this integral form here on the left-hand side and this integral form here on the right. And this is exactly the definition of a weak solution. So we have u times phi t plus this term here, which is our flux term, f of u times phi x dt dx. And then we still have this initial data term here. So u naught times phi of x comma zero dx equals zero. And so if you remember, this was exactly the definition of a weak solution that we wrote down several lectures ago. So this means that u is a weak solution. Okay. And sort of that concludes this theorem. Any questions so far? So as I mentioned, there are some subtleties and some details that I skipped over here that you may want to look at look up in the notes if you're interested. But this is just the general idea. Essentially, integrating on the discrete level and then taking the limit to L goes to infinity that converges to integral versions that exactly represent a weak solution. So that's the idea. Okay. I think since time is essentially up, so we only have 2 minutes left, there's no point in starting something new. So I will stop here. Essentially just noting that, as I mentioned earlier, now we only know that schemes in conservative form will, if they converge, will converge to a weak solution. But we don't know yet whether that weak solution is admissible. So we'll need to, next time, this is what we're going to start with on Thursday then, is to define a discrete version of the entropy conditions. And so these discrete versions of the entropy conditions will represent an additional constraint on any conservative scheme, which if is satisfied, the numerical solutions or the sequence of solutions as we refine our spatial and time discretization will then guarantee convergence to the entropy solution of the conservation law. And so then once we have this, we have the full sort of machinery at work, and then essentially we can start to write down conservative schemes, and we can sort of check that they satisfy all these constraints, and then we can actually use them for numerical experiments because then we sort of we can trust them and trust them that that they actually pick out the correct entropy solution for us. Okay, any final questions, idea, comments? Yeah, so again, this is sort of fairly abstract in general. We'll get to specific examples on Thursday once we define the discrete entropy condition. We'll introduce Godunov type schemes and then actually go through these steps sort of in concrete terms. And so you'll see how this general formalism is then applied to a specific case. Okay, good. Well, I don't want to keep you too long. So thanks everyone. Enjoy your evening and then see you on Thursday.